This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The different systems of values. We operate in the system of values adopted by the Olam Hazeh, by this world in which we live, the material physical world. And simultaneously we're operating in the system of values of the Olam Haba, of what we translate as the world to come. But that doesn't necessarily mean the place you go after you're dead. Some people don't go there after they're dead, and some people are there even before they're dead. It's really got nothing to do with that. The Olam Haba we refer to in the sense of being that system of values which doesn't require you to have a body and function in a material world in order to adhere to that system of values. That's what Olam Haba means. So we're continuously operating on the level simultaneously of Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. The system of values of the Olam Hazeh is the system of those values which can be measured, which can be quantified, which can be observed. When a value can be quantified and measured and observed, that's a value that belongs to the Olam Hazeh. When a value can't be quantified, and it can't be observed, and it can't be measured, it can only be felt, it can only be experienced, that's where one's in the realm of the Olam Haba. We're told in the Sedra today, Va'osu aroin atse shittim, make an ark out of shittim wood, that was a kind of a cedar, a very tall cedar tree. Amosayim v'chetzi orkoi v'amo v'chetzi rochboi, 2.5 amos by 1.5 amos, v'amo v'chetzi koimoso, and another 1.5 amos in height. V'tzipiso oisoi zohov tohir, and you must cover it with pure gold. Mibayis u'michutz tetzapenu. You must cover it from the outside and the inside. V'yosiso olav ze'azohav soviv, and you must make a golden crown around it. The words that we're concentrating are of v'tzipiso iso zohav tohir, mibayis u'michutz tetzapenu. You must cover the oron with gold from the inside and the outside. It was made from wood, but there was an outer container of gold and an inner container of gold, so that the wood was not visible at all. That's very strange, because nobody saw the inside of the Oron. After they put the tablets inside, the luchos there, and they put the Sefer Torah, which Moshe had written, inside the Oron, and they closed the kapores on top of the Oron, it was never open. Nobody looked inside there. Nobody saw it. It's almost like people who buy clothing with silk linings. I understand the attractiveness of it in a way, but it's a bit of a waste of money. A nice lining, all right, but a silk lining? Nobody said. The purpose of clothing is an outside projection of what you are, but that the inside should be as expensive and as beautiful as the outside is a bit difficult to understand. And here we see it with the Oron. That the inside was never seen. The Oron is basically made of wood, of Atzei Shittim. That's what the Oron is. That's what the Ark is. But it had to be covered with gold. I understand, you wanted to make it look very beautiful. So you cover it with gold, the lid is covered with gold, the sides are covered with gold, everything's covered with gold. But why line the inside with gold? Says Rava in the Medrash, in the Yalkut, Kol Talmid Chochom She'en Toichoi Kebaroi, Eino Talmid Chochom. Any Talmid Chochom whose inside is not like his outside is not a Talmid Chochom. What does that mean? The outside covering of the Oron was the Olam Hazeh covering. That was the quantifiable covering. If you wanted to look and evaluate the beauty of the Oron using eyes of Olam Hazeh, using quantifying eyes, using measuring eyes, you looked at it and it was made with gold. And an expert could gauge how much gold there was there, and in fact he could figure out how much it was worth at today's price of gold and yesterday's price of gold and tomorrow's price of gold. He can figure out exactly how expensive this Oron is. But the inside, he can't figure out anything at all. He doesn't know whether it is gold or it isn't, if it went for the fact that the Torah told us. And even if he knows that it's gold, he can't see how much gold. He can't see how thick the covering is. So he can tell nothing about the inside. The inside is the quality. Because anything which is not quantifiable is qualitative. When we talk about the Olam Hazeh being the system of values which is quantifiable and measurable, and the Olam Haba is the system of values which is not quantifiable, what we are saying in essence is that the Olam Hazeh operates according to systems of values which are quantitative, and the Olam Haba operates on a system of values which is qualitative, cannot be measured. And any value which is not quantitative is qualitative. So when it comes to looking at the inside of the ark, in other words, why is the inside of the ark covered? There's no logical reason you can give. There's no pragmatic reason. There's no practical reason why the inside of the ark should be covered. Only one. The integrity of the ark. That it shouldn't look to be in measurable terms more than it is in real terms. Although the gold is not very important, the main thing is that it should be able to hold the luchos. The wood was the essential part, not the gold. The gold was only a covering. But to cover it with something which is on the outside only and has nothing on the inside, that would impair the integrity of the aura. That's not good aesthetics. To have something which is aesthetically beautiful only on the outside where people see, and it's falling to pieces and rotting on the inside, that's not good aesthetics. It's aesthetics that lack integrity. And rather, equates the meticulousness with which the Oran was designed and the expense that was gone to design it in such a way, gold no less. And although it's only recently that gold went up higher than $32 an ounce, if you remember that far back, in those days it wasn't $32 an ounce, in those days it was more like it is today, there was a free market for gold in those days. So we're talking about an awful lot of money and an awful lot of effort to line it with gold where nobody will ever see the lining, just so that the outside should not look more than the inside is. That's the integrity of the Oroin. And says Rava, Kol Talmid Chacham She'ein Toichei Kabaroi, any Talmid Chacham whose inside is not like his outside, who is projecting an image greater than he is, frumer than he is, wiser than he is. It's not that judge him by what he really is, not by what he's on the outside. So if on the inside is a 70% Talmid Chacham, and on the outside is a 90% Talmid Chacham, you would think at least he gets 70%. No, he gets zero. That's a disqualification of a Talmid Chacham. Even if he's 98% on the inside and 99% on the outside, it's a disqualification of a Talmid Chacham. That's, I don't think, 100% correct, because as an aside, I might tell you that the outside covering of the Oron was higher than the inside. When it talks about a crown around it, what really was, you had the inside gold covering, the inside gold box, and then the middle wooden box were a certain height, 1.5 tefachim, 1.5 amos, and the outside gold one was considerably higher. So the lid fitted down and was held in place by the outside box. And that outside box was high enough not only to cover the lid, which was a tefach, but in fact to go still higher than the lid. And that was the zayah, that was the crown around the lid. So the lid fitted inside this outer covering. So we see that Tochei Kabaro, although the inside has to be the outside, they must both be from gold, the outside was a little bit higher than the inside. It was just a little bit more than the inside. And that is allowed to be because that creates the tensions inside a human being which drive him to progress. That he should be projecting an image just a little bit more than he really is, but it's a tiny bit. That yes, but essentially Tochei Kabaroi, his inside must be the same as his outside. There must be no disparity between them. The concept is one of ensuring that qualitatively one is living on the level that would be indicated by one's quantitative living. And we're going to explain that clearly. The man who's most given as the prime example and the founding father of all hypocrites was Esav. And really this shiur should be on Parshas Toldos. You might make a mark on it on the tape when we come to labeling the tapes. But by the time I'd finished it this afternoon, it was too late to prepare another one for Truma. So I'm going to give it to you on Truma. And we'll just remember that it goes on Toldos as well. The prime founder of hypocrites was Esav. That was the man who started the whole business. And if we want to understand hypocrisy, and after all that's what we're talking about here, that you're going to see we're talking about a very special type of hypocrisy, and a surprising type of hypocrisy. If we want to understand hypocrisy, the man we must study most carefully is Esav. Rabbi Yelopian Zatzal used to ask a magnificent kasha, magnificent question on Esav. Just listen to this question. It's incredible. There's a Gemara in Brachas Daf Hei Amud Aleph 5a that says the following, a well-known Gemara. Omer Rabbi Levi Bar Chama, Omer Rabbi Shimon Ben Lakish, Lo'olam Yargiz Odom Yetzer Tov Al Yetzer Hara. If you have a passion to do something which is not right, you should counteract that with your passion to do right. Don't approach it negatively. I mustn't do it, I mustn't do it, I mustn't do it. Rather counteract it with positive passion towards better things. Redirect your passion. Im nitzchoi mutav. If you manage, if you're successful, that's fine. V'im lav yasok b'toira. If not, then apply yourself intellectually. Learn, be creative in your learning. Im nitzchoi mutav. If you're successful, that means you're able to change your direction, and now you're being creative in your learning, and you're being attracted onto that, and you're sitting and you're not interested anymore in doing that which was wrong, then fine. V'im lav, what happens if it doesn't work? You just can't get this passion to do something wrong out of yourself. Then yikra kriyashma. Then you should read kriyashma very carefully. Read and understand what you're reading. Im nitzchoi mutav. If that works, that's fine. V'im lav, and if not, yizko lo yoyim hamisa. Just remind yourself that life doesn't go on forever. You're going to die one day. And then, believe it or not, the Gemara doesn't say im nitzchoi mutav, if that works very good, v'im lav, and if not, try something else. Stops there. Doesn't say im nitzchoi mutav, because it's jolly well going to work. That always works. If you can just get yourself clearly to understand that my life is going to end, and I must spend my time doing things which are going to have value after my life, not just things which are going to have value while I'm living and while I'm able to feel their immediate effect. That I've got to do things that have some kind of eternal value, that are important in a much bigger sense than my little life. That always works. That's a guarantee of the Gemara. That if you've tried everything else, you've got to go through the whole process. You can't start with that. If you start trying to redirecting your passions to do good things, because everybody wants to do good things as well. And if that doesn't work, you learn. And if learning doesn't help, you read Kriyashma. And if Kriyashma doesn't help and you remember the day of your death, that, says Rebellia in learning this Gemara, is a guarantee to work. Fine, that's clear. That's clearly so. But you remember the story with Esav and Yaakov. Esav comes in literally dead, tired and hungry from the field and says, give me some of that stuff that you're making. Yaakov says, sure, I'll do a deal with you. Sell me your birthright and I'll give you the soup. Esav is in a position now of wanting to do something wrong. It's a question, does he sell his soul for the soup or doesn't he? And he finds himself in the typical battle between a Yetzer HaTov and a Yetzer Hara. What does Esav say? Hinei anoichi holech lomus. You know, Yaakov, I'm about to die one of these days. So you would think he would say, I'm about to die. Don't think I'm going to sell my soul for a little bit of rubbish. V'lamazeli b'chayra, what do I need it for? Give me the soup rather. Asks Rebellion. We had a guarantee in Gemara Brochus that if you remember the day of you're going to die, you won't do something idiotic. And Esav's downfall results from doing that very thing. Esav's downfall results from remembering the day of his death and finding that as a result of remembering it, his bechayra, his birthright, becomes meaningless. It ceases to have meaning to him. Where's the logic? Answers rebellion. If you're operating in the Olam Haba as well, if you're operating with qualitative values, then when you think of the day of your death, what you're saying to yourself is quantitative values have limited value, whereas qualitative values have infinite value. I can't swap one for the other. I can't swap a qualitative value for a quantitative value. That's bad business. That's what remembering the day of death means. But if you only live in the quantitative world, if you don't live in the qualitative world, if everything you think of is in terms of quantity, how do you quantify the value of a bechora, especially if you're going to die? If you're not going to die, a bechora has quantitative value because you get twice the inheritance. Your brother only gets half. So then it is of quantitative importance to hang on to the Bechorah. But if I'm going to die in any case before you, Yaakov, before my brother, I'm going to die, then my Bechorah has no quantitative value. And I don't appreciate the existence of any qualitative values. Then I can understand why Yaakov, why Esav says, Lama li Bechorah, what do I need it for? Says Rebellia, the guarantee that remembering the day of your death will stop you doing something silly only works if you have a system of qualitative values too, but you find yourself in a mess trying to sort out which is which. Then remember the day of your death, and that will reduce the value, it will devalue your quantitative system a little bit. And you'll see your qualitative system in its right perspective. But if you don't have a qualitative system, it will do nothing. Okay, that's one aspect of Esav I want to show you. The other aspect is also an amazing thing. Vayomer Esav el Yaakov. Esav says to Yaakov when he comes in from the field, Hal iteni no min ha'odoim ha'odoim hazeh. Give me some of this red stuff. Yaakov was busy making lentils, adoshim. He was making lentils because Avram, his grandfather, had died that day, and his father Yitzchak was an ovel, he was a mourner. And it was the minhag to give a mourner lentils because they were round, like we eat eggs today. So he says, give me some of this red stuff, ki oyef anoichi, because I'm tired. Al kein koro shemoi edoim. Therefore, for that reason, Yaakov called Esav Edom. That's a very derogatory word, the red one. And it's become to be Edom, the hated nation. At this point, Esav became the father of the hated nation of Edom. And Yaakov said, sell me today your birthright. Says the Sipurna, and I brought the Sipurna to you before. Al ken koro shemoi Edom. Therefore he called his name Edom. Why did he call his name Edom? One would have thought that he should have called him Edom because he had red hair. But then he should have been called Edom when he was born. Now all of a sudden they call him Edom. What's the occasion? Says the Sipurna, Kesheroi, when Yaakov saw Esav, Shekol kach hismoche limelachtoi hanifsedes, that he was so dedicated to his business, to his business of limited value, more so than is humanly normal, to the extent that he could only recognize this dish by its color. He didn't even call it by its name. He just gave me some of this red stuff. He didn't even know what it was. So involved was he in his business. Korosh Shemoi Edom. He called him Edom Loshen Tzivui in the imperative Kloima. That means his Adem Veheyet Tzavua Odom Behalosas Odom. Make yourself red as you spill the stuff in your face while you gobble it up. That's what Yaakov, it was a word of disgust. Yaakov basically said, here, make yourself red with the stuff if that's all you can see. Yaakov got angry. Then he says, Michra Kayom, sell me your birthright, says the Sipurnu. Ki Behayos Hayom Kol Magomas Panecho El Melachtecho. Since today your whole ambition is directed towards your work, your profession. To the extent that you come home so tired that you can't even recognize the dish. You certainly aren't able and capable of dealing in matters of the birthright. To serve God and to do that which a bechor, which a firstborn is meant to do. Come home that tired that you call the stuff red, just red stuff, you don't call it by its real name, you're no good. You know, Esav fooled his father Yitzchak for a long time. Yitzchak, we find this very difficult to understand. It's one of the most difficult things in the Tanakh, to understand how Yitzchak was fooled into thinking that Esav should be the heir, his spiritual heir. It's not that Yitzchak didn't value Yaakov. Yitzchak valued Yaakov very much indeed. But still he considered Esav as not having given up his rights to be the Bechor. Esav, what we hear about Esav, what we learn about Esav, how did he fool Yaakov? How did he fool Yitzchak? Yitzchak is the kind of man that you can imagine. Any one of us would have put our lives in Yitzchak's hand. We would have gone to Yitzchak as total strangers and asked him a shayla. We would have taken a prospective wife to Yitzchak, who'd never seen us or our wives before, and said, Yitzchak, should we marry her or not? A man with Ruach HaKodesh, a man connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam, with a spiritual force that's beyond understanding and beyond belief, with a perception of life and of human beings, Yitzchak we would have trusted with any value judgment and with any personal judgment. We wanted to take somebody into our businesses and Yitzchak said don't, we wouldn't. Yitzchak said do, we would. So much would we have trusted Yitzchak's judgment. And his own son, he's totally off beam. Esav has managed to pull the wool right over Yitzchak's eyes. How does he do it? And so much, let's just see how much he's been able to pull the wool over his eyes. What does Yaakov catch Esav out on? He doesn't say, Esav, you know, you don't daven in the mornings. So how can you be the Bechor? How can you take over? He doesn't say that. Yaakov never caught Esav not davening in the mornings. And you can be quite sure that Yaakov was watching, because Yaakov realized that Esav wasn't fit for it, but he had to find the moment of convincing Esav that he wasn't fit for it. So you can be quite sure that Yaakov was watching. Esav was there, never missed a davening. Not a shachris, not a mincha, not a ma'ariv. You can be quite sure that Yaakov never found Esav eating treif. Never once. If he did, then Yaakov would have said at that time, you can't be the Bechor, you can't be the spiritual leader of Am Yisrael, one of the founding fathers of Am Yisrael, how can you be if you're eating treif? He never caught him eating treif. He never caught him doing something wrong by an Adam Lechavero, he never caught him talking Lashon Hora, he never caught him being dishonest in his business. Yaakov, who was living with Esav from birth, they were twins. His twin brother, on what does he catch him? Hey, you don't know what this dish is called. That's what I catch you on. You're not fit to be the Bechor. You call it red stuff. That's the only thing that Yaakov, his twin brother, can catch Esav out of. Can you imagine how trum he must have looked? Can you imagine how meticulous he must have been in his mitzvahs? So that his own brother and his father and his mother, nobody caught him out on anything else. He kept everything meticulously. Nobody saw him doing things that he shouldn't have been doing. If that's the case, it's difficult to understand the Sipurnu and what Rabbi Elyalopian said. If he was so involved in Yiddishkeit that nobody noticed that there was anything wrong with him. Yaakov didn't notice, and Yitzchak didn't notice, and Rivka didn't notice. Nobody noticed there was anything wrong with him. They might have felt that he wasn't right, but nobody could catch him out until this episode. So he must have davened every day, as we said. He must have been learning too, because he used to talk to his father in learning. He used to ask his father very frum kashas, very, very meticulous questions, shilas he used to discuss with his father. So he was talking and learning with his father. If his father found that the son knew nothing about Torah, you can be quite sure he wouldn't have been fooled. So his father must have been able to enjoy a discussion in learning with his son Esav. So he's involved in learning. He's davening. He's keeping the mitzvahs. He's doing kindness. He's honoring his father like nobody ever since has ever honored a parent. This is one of the mitzvahs that Esav absolutely excelled in. So how bad can his involvement in business be? He's davening every day, he's learning every day, he's talking to his father, he's honoring his father, he's doing kindnesses, he's not talking Lashon Hora, nobody can catch him out on anything. How much can his involvement in business be that the Sipurna has to say, Sheroi kol kach hismachel l'mlachto, he was so dedicated to his business that he was unable to appreciate what the Nezid Adoshim really was. How can Rabbi Elyalopian say that this is a man who wasn't living with spiritual values at all? Because if he was living with spiritual values when he remembered the day of his death, that would have solved his conflict. This is a man who was only living with material values, so why is he davening every day? Why is he learning? Why is he doing all the mitzvahs? What we have to say is that it's possible even within that kind of operation to be doing all the mitzvahs, to be learning and davening and keeping everything, and still not to be living in the Olam Haba. Still not to be living with a qualitative style of life and with a qualitative set of values. It's possible to be meticulous in everything one's doing, and one's still only living quantitatively, one's not living qualitatively. And what's the test? The Nezid Adoshim. Just the ability to notice what things really are. What does Yaakov catch him out on? Don't call this by its most superficial name. Don't just call it red stuff. That's its most superficial, the way it appears to you most superficially. That's a sign that you're involved in quantitative things. That's a sign that you haven't noticed what's going on here. Why am I making the Zid Adoshim all of a sudden? Why am I cooking lentils? Don't you realize that that's something one makes for an ovel, for somebody who's died, for somebody who's mourning the death of a close one? Who could it be? The only Avil it could be is our father, and who could he be mourning? Only his father. Don't you realize that Avraham Avinu has died today? Now I realize that you're a nobody, says Yaakov. And now you're going to sell me your birthright or you'll die. But you're not fit to carry on the Jewish people. You're not fit to be the heir of our father Yitzchak. Why do I realize? Because you haven't noticed the meaning, the value, the quality of something I'm doing. You're only relating to it on its most superficial level. That's very serious. At that point, Esav disqualifies himself and becomes Edom. And Chazal tell us, why did Avraham die on that day? Because that's the day that Esav started departing. That's the day Esav started going bad. It started with the Nezid Adoshim. That was the day that Avraham died. God wanted to spare Avraham seeing his grandson going off the tracks. And where does he go off the tracks? By not noticing that the brother is cooking lentils, by seeing only that it's red stuff. By not being able to relate to the essence of the things around him. Very much like that which we discussed in the Chumashir about calling the names to the various animals. And this is something which is disturbing. Because I was saying to somebody today that we must be careful to see that in our pursuit of Torah we don't become narrow. And that one begins to worry about a certain loss of interest in the world around one. So it's not that important. And you remember from last week's share that when you're not interested in something, you don't notice it. And all of a sudden, people stop noticing. They stop noticing each other. They stop noticing their wives. They stop noticing their children. They stop noticing their colleagues, their friends, their wider family. The birds tweeting in the tree, the sun shining. They just stop noticing everything and they start operating like zombies. They're learning, they're davening, they're doing everything that has to be done. But there's a spark of interest in the world around that is lost. And this person said to me, "Oh, you know, when you're so busy running from one shir to another, you forget that there's even a world out there altogether." That's what I'm worried about. That's Esav. That's not Yaakov. That's Esav. Forgetting that there's a world out there. Never mind losing interest in that world out there. That's Esav. That's not the Jewish way of things. That's not Yaakov. Yaakov was Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. He was settled in his Beis HaMedrash. He was learning. But it's Yoshev Ohalim. He was settled. He wasn't running around like Meshuggah. Settled, quiet, learning nicely. We'll come back to that in a moment. But before that, I want to analyze very briefly what happened to Esav. Esav was doing all the right things, but there was no quality to what he was doing. And he fooled his father, he fooled everybody. Everybody thought that Esav was a man of very great stature. The most tragic thing of all is that there's no way Esav could have fooled everybody if he hadn't first fooled himself. And that's the kind of hypocrite I want to talk about today. Now there's a Gemara in Soto where Yanai HaMelech, who was a wicked king, he killed many Chachomim during his reign. And when he was about to die, his wife was very worried that the Chachomim, the Perushim, the Frum element, were going to take it out on her and her children and would try and remove the kingdom away from her family. Amar lo Yanai Malka Lidvite. So at that time, Yanai, the king, said to his wife, Al tisyori min haPerushim. Don't worry about the Perushim, about the Frum community. Says Rashi, because they're tzaddikim, they're not going to hurt people who've done nothing wrong. And don't worry about the reform element either. At that time there was the tzaddikim, which was a big reform element. Don't worry about them, because they're my friends. We're of the same political persuasion, so you don't have to worry that they'll do anything to you. Just watch out for the hypocrites, that's all. Because they look exactly like the Frum ones. You can't discriminate between the hypocrites and the Frum ones. It's impossible. You know the story of Zimri and Pinchas, where Zimri took a non-Jewish girl and had relations with her virtually publicly in front of everybody as a mockery of the whole system of our social being. And Pinchas came and killed them both on the spot and was praised for it. And says Yanai the king, they do acts like Zimri and they claim schar like Pinchas. They want to be recognized like Pinchas. They murder people that they murder people and they say it was in the name of God. Don't worry, this was L'shem Shemayim. Those are the people to be aware of. And Daimin Lifrushim, why you've got to be so careful, is because they look exactly the same as the Prushim. You can't tell which is which. It's a frightening thing. During the guerrilla war in Rhodesia, whenever I used to go there, they used to tell me, you know what wears us down most of all in guerrilla warfare is the fact that, look, he says, we're walking in the streets here. That man might be my enemy, that man might be him, that one might be him. I don't know who he is. That's what kills us. That's what's wearing us down emotionally. The servant who works for you and has worked for you for 50 years can be an enemy of yours. You just don't know. There used to be a time when the enemy used to declare himself, when there was a chivalry even in warfare. The enemy used to dress up in a different uniform from you, and he used to declare, I'm your enemy, and we used to declare war and fight it out. That was when there was chivalry in warfare. Now it's cowardly. You don't know who the enemy is. He won't come out. And that's the danger. That's the thing that can break a society completely. And that's the tzivuim, the hypocrites. If you know that somebody's a rosha, there's no problem. One can relate to him easily. If you know that somebody's a tzaddik, no problem. You can relate to him easily. But those people who look identical, and I'm sorry to say that the tzivuim, the skillful tzivuim, the skillful hypocrites, do look identical. There's no way you can separate them from the outside. They look like a normal tzaddik. That's all. But the inside is not like the outside. I'm not even worried about those, funnily enough. Because those, even those can be identified. A man who's trying to fool the world can be identified. Sooner or later, you can pick him up. I'm worried about another kind of tzivua. The man who succeeded in fooling himself. And then takes on the world with all the conviction of a man who knows what he's doing. He's the dangerous one, because that guy is not easy to pick up. A man who's convinced himself that he's a tzaddik, and now he's only going to try and convince the world, or he's not even going to try and convince the world gets convinced automatically. He's the man to worry about. What goes wrong? And this is our second shir on the midvah sheker tirchak, of keeping away from dishonesty and keeping away from lies. And the most dangerous lie of all is the lie to yourself about yourself. A lie to somebody else is bad. A lie about somebody else is bad. But the most destructive lie is a lie to yourself about yourself. Now let's use the same principle that we developed last week to understand the nature of this particular hypocrite. What did we say a lie was? Or that what promoted, what motivated a lie? It was a human being who confused fiction with fact. And we said that fiction starts with a theme, and then the author creates facts to serve the theme. And it's unimportant whether the facts really occurred or not, as long as the theme is being conveyed and illustrated. That's what fiction is. Fact or history is when you start with the facts and you try and extract out of the facts some kind of system, some kind of theme from the facts. That's the difference. A liar is a person who starts with a theme. And when the facts don't fit the theme, he alters the facts. That's what it is. In a greater or a lesser degree, that's what a liar is. How does it apply to this kind of hypocrite, to this kind of tzavua that we're talking about? Esav started with a theme. What was his theme? I'm a tzaddik. I'm righteous. I'm the grandson of Avraham. I'm the son, the oldest son of Yitzchak. I'm the heir to the throne and the spiritual heritage of the Jewish people. I'm a tzaddik. That's where he starts. That's his theme. And that's where the danger is. You start off as the tzaddik, and you try then to do that which a tzaddik does. Now Esav must ask himself, well, in my capacity as tzaddik, what am I meant to do? I'm meant to daven every day, I'm meant to do this, that and the other, and he does everything he's meant to do as a tzaddik. But it's all quantitative. It's not qualitative. He started off with the theme. The theme was, I'm a tzaddik. And then he bent the facts to serve that theme. And that's the hypocrite that I'm worried about. The man who starts off with a theme about himself. He starts off with a decision as to who I am. I'm a this, or I'm a that. It doesn't even have to be a tzaddik. I'm a frum Jew. That's my starting point. I'm a frum Jew. Right. Now what is a frum Jew meant to do? He's meant to learn, he's meant to daven, he's meant to keep kosher, he's meant to keep taras and mishpacha, he's meant not to talk lashon hara. And let's say this man does everything that a frum Jew is supposed to do. It's still the wrong way around. The way to do it is, let's start with the facts. What do I do? Now, having seen what I do, what am I? That's the way one has to look at oneself and understand one's self-image. Not start with the self-image and make the facts fit it. But start with the facts and then decide what is my self-image as a result of those facts. And this is where we have the big danger area. Because the tendency is to start with preconceived ideas as to what is meant of one, what is one supposed to be doing. And if you look at it in that term, sort of objectively, assuming I'm supposed to be a Talmid Chacham, what am I supposed to be doing? Well, I'm supposed to be learning as much as possible, so you fit in as much learning as possible. I'm supposed to be davening, I'm supposed to be doing this, that and the other, and you make yourself a whole program. You're doing it all. And where's the richness of life? Where's the quality of living? Where's the inside? Where's the fulfillment and satisfaction? It doesn't come. It's not there. What's the right way to do it? The Vilna Gaon has a whole system in the book of Mishle whereby he illustrates the contrast of tzaddik and rosha, of righteous and wicked, on two parallel themes. He starts in the simple, righteous and wicked, in actions. And then he brings it right inside the Beis HaMedrash. And he says, in one's learning, this kind of learning is the learning of a tzaddik, and this kind of learning is the learning of a rosha. And there are a few that are very beautiful. The one is, in Mishle chapter Yud, chapter 10, on verse 4, Rash oseh chafrimiya, a palm of cheating makes one poor. So obviously there's a similar translation to what that means. It says the Vilna Gaon in all his brilliance what that means. What is a palm? You're showing only the surface of the hand. The next part of the sentence talks about yad charutzim ta'ashir, the hands of industrious people makes one wealthy. Says the Vilna Gaon, Rash oseh chafrimiya. If you're only looking at the hand, you're only looking at what is visible, what people can see. And it's not the thing in its totality. Says the Vilna Gaon, in learning, that's where you only learn the din. You learn, this is what you must do. And you don't learn the totality of it, you don't learn it with its roots. Asks the Vilna Gaon, why should anybody do something so stupid? Why should anybody learn only the result? Just the final line, just to know what the end of it is, without going through the whole development of the concept. Is the Vilna Gaon for one reason only, and that's to crook. To create the impression of being very frum, of knowing it all. And I've only understood today that he's not talking only about crooking others. He's talking about crooking yourself too. Because if you know all the dinim, assuming you know the whole of Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, you know the whole of Chayei Odom, even know the whole of Mishnah Brura, let's say. I know it all. I know, you can ask me anywhere it is, and I know it. And even if I don't tell anybody that I've learnt it all, I know my own self-satisfaction that I know it all. Says the Vilna Gaon, that's not the way to learn. You've got to know the background of it, where it comes from, what it's based on, how it's developed. He says, and if you don't, you're doing it only to crook yourself. You're not doing it because you're really learning. And rush, oyseh chafrimiyo, that makes you poor because you're going to forget it all again. There's no way you can remember things which aren't integrated, things which aren't seen in their correct perspective, things which aren't understood in full, with the full depth of understanding that is necessary for them. There's no way you can understand that. And he says it all even more powerfully in chapter Yud Gimel, at the end of chapter 13, in a posuk which I have quoted before. Tzadik oichel l'soiva nafshoi uveten reshoim techsa. A tzadik eats and he's satisfied with his eating. And a rosha, his tummy is always empty. This is a very simple understanding of that. One of the difference between physical fulfillment and spiritual fulfillment is that physical fulfillment ceases to be fun the moment it's over. The best time of physical fulfillment is when you're hungry and the food is in the kitchen and you can smell it. That's the best time for the Yetzer Hara. That's the time that one gets most excitement out of fulfilling one's physical desires. The moment you finished eating, it's all gone. And you're left empty as you were before. A spiritual experience is the other way around. It's frustrating until you've done it. But when you've done it and it's settled and finished, that's when it feels good. So when a tzaddik eats, he's eating as a spiritual job. He's not only eating because he's hungry. He's eating as a spiritual service as well. And when he's finished, there's some spiritual satisfaction left over. Whereas if one's a rosho, if one's only living quantitatively, when the food is down, it's gone. There's no more pleasure. That's the simple understanding of the posuk. But again, the Vilna Gaon, in all his brilliance, brings this right into the Beis HaMedrash. And says, tzaddik oichel l'soiva nafsho. What does it mean that a tzaddik eats to satisfy himself? He says, Hatzadik loymed, I think these are the words precisely, he says, Hatzadik loymed, kedei she yispa, bichdei she yispa. A tzaddik learns in order to feel satisfied. It's very egoistical, isn't it? But that's the amazing thing, that when you do what your neshama craves for, it's egoistical to your neshama, it's spiritually egoistical. But something which is spiritually egoistical is not physically egoistical. Because if it was physically egoistical, it wouldn't satisfy the neshama. So tzaddik, a tzaddik loymed bichdei she yispa. He learns in order to feel good. If you ask the tzaddik, why do you sit and learn all day? It's because I like the feeling. That's what motivates me. Bichdei she yispa. Ve'einoy roye im ma'at im harbe. And he doesn't notice whether he's learnt a lot or a little. He doesn't even notice the quantity. If you say to him, how much did you learn today? He says, I don't know. I'll have to sit and work it out. It's not important. He doesn't know how much he's learnt. He doesn't see whether it's much or it's little. And going back to last week, you don't see that which you're not interested in. He's not interested in whether it's much or little. Rak, kedei sheyeda bevorio. All he wants is that he should know the thing in all its clarity, with all its principles and all its basis. The yispa nafsha. And his soul will feel satisfaction as a result of that. That's when the neshama feels fulfilled, when one's learning. When one comes to the end of something and it's clear, then the neshama feels good. The neshama gets absolutely no fulfillment from how much one has done, how much one has learned, how much one has achieved. The neshama gets no such fulfillment. And one mustn't fool oneself when one ends a day and says, I've learned 5 daf today, it was fantastic. That's not the neshama that feels fantastic. To the neshama, numbers are totally meaningless. The only thing that the neshama feels satisfied at the end of it is how much I know today. What I know with clarity, look how much I know, that much more today than I knew yesterday. And the neshama, with one new little piece of knowledge, as long as it's knowledge, real, meaningful, substantial, it can be one little thing, that makes the neshama feel fulfilled. That makes one feel spiritually satisfied. Whereas you can learn hundreds of pages, if you don't know them well, the neshama gets no satisfaction out of that at all. And the Vilna Gaon calls that the difference between a tzaddik and a rosha. You can be a tzaddik although you're learning and learning. He says only a rosha will turn the page before he understands the first page. A rosha, that's strong words, a wicked man, says the Vilna Gaon, will turn one page before he understands the previous one. Unless he's still going to be going over it and over it and over it. He says, why should a tzaddik go on to the next thing before you understand the first thing? Sure, one has to have time set aside to do a bit of covering ground. But that's a miserable thing one has to do. So you set aside from such and such a time to such and such a time. I'm going to do so many pages. And you get through it and you push. As I said earlier on, you'll never do the Sedra. If you sit and you'll try and understand the first Rashi properly, you'll never finish it. So you have to decide, look, I've got 2 hours. I'm going to finish the whole Sedra. And then you finish it. But then that's not enough. At the end of that, you've got to say, right. And now I want an hour on one Rashi of my choice. Gone through the whole Sedra, I'm going to pick out one Rashi. My neshama wants a nachas today too. I'm going to take one Rashi and I'm going to spend half an hour or an hour or an hour and a half just on this one Rashi, playing with it, understanding it, questioning it, analyzing it, being creative with it, just having fun with it. That's what the neshama likes the intellect to involve itself in. And this really is the danger of the kind of tzavua, of the kind of hypocrite we're talking about. He first defines his business. I am a tzaddik. I am a learner. I am a Talmid Chacham. I am a frum Jew. And then he does those things which he believes such a man is meant to do. He does what he believes is expected of him. And he's missing the boat entirely. Because when you do it that way, you're doing it quantitatively. You're not doing it qualitatively. When you're doing it that way, there can't be any spiritual fulfillment, and consequently there can't be any spiritual growth. Whereas the other man says, look, I'm living. I don't know what I am. I don't know if I'm a tzaddik or a rosh or a talmid chacham or an oritz. I don't know. Let's see. We'll see as time goes on, we'll see. I want to live richly. I want to try and do that which is right. I want to try and be straight. I want to try and be true. I want to try and be correct. I want to try and reach depth in everything I do. I want to try and understand what this world is all about. And he sets about it. And in his business dealings, he tries to be as straight as he can. And he comes home in the evening and he wants to learn. So he finds a shiur or a chavrusa, or he learns by himself. He takes something and he works on it and works just to understand what it says. Not worried about how much ground he covers. If he understands one thing tonight, that will be wonderful, because tomorrow he can understand a second thing. And 14 things. And by the end of 4 weeks, he'll understand 28 things. And so it mounts and mounts and mounts. And before long, he'll be able to look at himself and say, what am I? I'm straight in my business. Checks it out. I'm straight in my business. Did I talk Lashon Hara? No. Did I do Chesed? Yes, every single day. Helped somebody out here. It was so good. Noticed that somebody needed something there. Stepped in. Did this. Did that. Very good. Learning. Gee, what I know. I started off not knowing anything, and now I know 16 things. Let's say that's all he knows. 16 things I know well, really well. He says, what am I? I'm a Talmid Chacham. Now you're a Talmid Chacham, and that's the way it starts. First doing the things, and then questioning, what is it that you're doing? But the most important thing is to remember the area of testing. The big danger is to confuse the benefit being gained by your physical being and the benefit being gained by your neshama. When you have a thrill at having learned 50 daf of Gemara, that's not the neshama that has the thrill. That's the same thrill that the businessman has when he makes 50,000 rand. It's the same feeling. And it's the same area that is being fulfilled. And there's no good standing and saying, I'm a spiritual person. 50 daf of Gemara, that's all I'm interested. I'm just interested in Gemara. How can you waste your time making money? He's collecting money. Somebody else collects stamps. You collect pages. As we've said many times before, it's the same thing. When a man sits and he says, I've understood something today. I've understood something about the world. Then it's the neshama. But the tendency is to be very confused about it. It's not easy to know which is getting the fulfillment. Yaakov teaches us the test. Don't check how many mitzvahs you did today. Don't check how many daf gemara you did today, because Esav did the same. Always just remind yourself. Whenever you're feeling good at the end of the day, just remind yourself, Esav did the same. That's it. Whenever you think that you're a real frum Jew and there's nobody frumer, just say to yourself, Esav thought the same. Right? And we don't want to be identified with Esav. Yaakov is the opposite of an Esav. How did Yaakov catch Esav out? This red stuff. Are you noticing the world around you with more perception than you used to before? Are you relating with more sensitivity to what the world is all about? Are you able to define things correctly? Are you able to notice that when they're cooking something in the kitchen, it's Nezid Adoshim, which is used for mourning, so somebody's died? Are you able to notice and be sensitive to small human changes? Are you able to be sensitive to qualitative things which you can't quite put your finger on, but just feel that something's wrong or something's right? Are your powers of being able to relate to these little qualitative things increasing? Can you listen to a piece of music and enjoy it more? Can you read a book and see much more inside it, whether critically or positively? Can you see some theatre and see in it something more than you did before? One has to understand, we're not on the levels where we can live the kind of lives that the real tzaddikim of old used to live. Where we can cut ourselves off completely and get our total richness and fulfillment only from the learning. Halavai, we should be there. But until we get there, we mustn't narrow ourselves down to the point that we're unable to notice what happens in the world around. Until we get there, it's necessary to involve ourselves in the world around, to be aware of what's going on and increase our sensitivity constantly, and be able to test whether we're improving in that area. to be able to notice the message behind things, to be able to notice from people's body language how they're feeling, to be able to notice from the way things, furniture is placed in a house, what kind of a person lives in that house. To be able to notice from the fact that Nazida Adoshim are being cooked, that your grandfather Chas V'Shalom has passed away. These little things, to be able to notice these little things, then you know that you're living a qualitative life, and that you're becoming a Talmid Chacham, that you're becoming a frum person, that you're becoming a Ben Torah. That's the test. Not how much you're doing, because how much you're doing is something quantitative. So we're dealing tonight with a second kind of liar, the most tragic of all liars, the man who lies to himself. And he does it with the same innocence that our liar lied last week. The liar isn't malicious. Last week he wasn't a malicious liar. Don't forget, we distinguished last week between a crook and a liar. A man who lies for financial gain is not a liar, he's a thief. That's something else. We talked about the liar who tells lies not for financial gains, where it doesn't hurt anybody, they're just not accurate, that's all. And we said, why should a person say something which is inaccurate if he's got nothing to gain and that somebody else has got nothing to lose? And we defined it. And we said, because he's decided on the theme before he saw the facts. And the most tragic liar of all is the liar who's decided on his own theme before he's seen the facts. He's taken his role like a theatre role. The actor comes to the producer and says, what am I supposed to be today? You're supposed to be King Lear, I think it is. And he checks up, yeah, you're going to be King Lear. Right, now he's King Lear, that's his theme. And now he will do that which King Lear does. That's acting. That's not being real. Being real is, I'll do what I think is right. I'll battle to try and live the way I would like to live. Now tell me, producer, who am I? What am I? Am I King Lear? Am I a tzaddik? That's when it becomes real living. That's when it's not fake. This is our second liar. I hope in Mirza Hashem that next week we'll be able to speak about a third liar who is not as pathetic as this one, possibly equally dangerous, and something that one has to watch equally carefully. The point that I wish to make very clearly about our liar this week, I think, is obvious. Don't worry about him that much in other people. Number one, you won't notice him. You won't find this guy. He's too skillful. If Yitzchak couldn't find it in Esav, believe me, none of us are going to notice it in other people. Just let's be very careful that we don't have it inside ourselves. Just let's be very careful that we're not acting, that we're living real lives, and that our self-images are the results of analyzing what we do, and not that we do that which we think we're meant to be doing in terms of our images.